Welcome back after the exciting fall break. I'm sure you guys had a very relaxing time. Am I loud enough? It's hard for me to tell. Is this okay? Is the audio okay? Yeah? All right, so lecture 14, October 9th, 2023, lecture notes, pages 115. Just a reminder about this KSU Sales Club. If you have an interest in learning about sales as a focus, that's available. Contact Sydney. A reminder, if you want an honors thesis project information, October 10th in the Design Innovation Hub. So here we are on Columbus and some people say Indigenous Peoples Day, lecture 14, working through our week here. Mini test 6 will close tomorrow since we were on fall break. I didn't close it on Sunday. I gave you some extra time to work on it, but being us, we had to pick up with mini test 7, so it'll open on Tuesday. It'll close on Sunday, so that ongoing schedule is running. Enhanced Learning Extra Credit and Pack Back number 4 closed last Wednesday. Average score was 0.26. So again, those extra credit points are beginning to add up. You've added 1% to your final course grade on average. And the next one will open Thursday the 12th and open a week later on Wednesday the 18th. So the midterm came and went. The score is exactly where, well, actually 1 point away from where we'd expect it to be as forecast after semester of students. Many students don't make use of the book. Many students don't make use of their notes, which is one reason why we don't have a higher average, in my opinion. You are not in the clear yet in terms of the system saying, were you cheating or not? It's still working its way through. I will let you know if there's a problem. My current thinking on how to handle this is if it accuses you of cheating, I'll explain why it says you're cheating. And I think what I'm going to do is, unless it's blatant, because sometimes things look a little marginal and we could fuss, I'm going to say, look, here's what it saw. Here's why it reported you. If you engage in this same behavior next time, I'm counting both exams as a zero. So whatever it's looking at, it thinks your cat is giving you answers. Next time, don't be talking to your cat. I'm only kidding. Actually, your cat can't give you answers. I know that. I'm giving you a silly example to make my point. So it's going to work its way through. If it feels there's something wrong, I'm going to let you know. I'm not going to dock you this time. But if you do whatever it is again, I'm going to give you a zero on both. Got to ensure academic integrity some way. All right? Any questions on my current plan? And of course, that's not you, that's the other person over there that we're worrying about, yeah? All right, so how'd it turn out? Right where I said it would, because I make it turn out, 72%. All right, top score, I haven't looked at the system to see why the top score is so high, but 105% with the curve, okay? Someone just brought to my attention that the last update to your grades apparently did not update your letter grade. So the percent is right after the midterm exam. The letter grade is the old letter grade before the midterm exam. I will look and see what happened and why it didn't update that. So somebody had a fairly low new score after the test. They didn't do that well, but the grade is still a B. Well, no, it's not a B, it's something else. So I'm gonna work on that. Anytime you see a question like that, let me know there's something wrong. All right, any questions on what I just said? Most people seem to have no problems with proctorio. Most people had no problems with the test, knock wood. So either the system's gotten better or you've gotten better at it over time, but seems like it was as it should be. Midterm grades were posted, and in your grade book now, you'll see whatever I said your midterm grade was. It should look just like your current grade, except I did not include the most recent enhanced or extra credit, so it might be off by a few tenths of a point. In your grade book, the midterm overall class grade is 81%. Again, right in line with what we expect it to be. If you refer back to that first week when I said what would the scores be, this is what they are. All right, this was an interesting business in the news story. Peak TV is over. A different Hollywood is coming. The labor pact writers struck with studios and streamers. Anybody in HR here? HR? Yeah, so I pick on this one in particular because it is one of the few examples we have of an actual HR example in business news. was struck with studios and streamers ending a 5-month strike will likely accelerate the retrenchment that was already underway in Hollywood for more than a year. It represented a formal end to peak TV, a decade that included an explosion of programming for viewers and job opportunities for talent in Tinseltown. So there's a bit of HR in business. Writers won major concessions in the deal, including new bonus payouts and higher royalties. These hard-won victories are especially important given the hard financial realities of the entertainment business. The streaming companies will have to find a way to pay increased talent costs without adding to their overall production costs. A little bit then about the cost of doing business and business. That will likely mean the companies will make fewer new shows and cancel even more that are on the bubble. So the impact of this on the product. How many of you guys over time have had a show you're watching, you like it, and they don't renew it? It was on the bubble, I guess, with a bunch of people. They didn't see the worth in carrying it on. In the deal, the studios are allowed to build artificial intelligence tools and train them on writers' scripts after rejecting a demand from writers that they pledged not to do that. However, writers get some significant AI protections too. They won't lose out on writing credits or compensation when AI tools are used to assist in creating scripts. So here's the impact of one of those crest factors, technology, on business. Today, a key issue is that there are too many streaming services. That's creating confusion for consumers and hopeless economics for the companies. Consolidation, whether in the form of mergers or joint ventures or bundles, has to come from the streaming world for the industry to be viable. So how many of you guys, individually or maybe in your family, how many of you guys in the recent cycle have canceled at least one streaming service? Look at how many people said it's too much, either it's too expensive or too confusing or I don't need it. I forget if I shared, literally my wife said, we're paying like $385 a month for our streaming services plus our media, blah, 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 blah. And then on top of that, we don't even know what we're paying. We're paying somebody else. We're paying Hulu. I don't know what else we're paying. She said, you really ought to look at it and figure out what we could get rid of. I said, it's too much work. I don't know which shows are on what networks. I don't know what to get rid of. But other people are getting rid of stuff very wisely. So this is the idea of an industry having a life cycle. It grows and it gets some maturity, and then pretty soon it runs into problems, which is what this industry seems to be doing. The cost of streaming subscriptions has risen sharply over the past year as entertainment companies focus on acquiring customers, and growth at all costs gave way to a profitability push. That trend is likely to continue, and the costs of the strike settlement will give streamers one more reason to lift their prices. So price in the marketing mix. Some of you guys have noticed and paid attention to a recent price increase in one of your services. Okay? I love it when whatever we're talking about in marketing the news is in the news. From this morning's news, as I was coming into work, a story from NPR.
Streaming services are turning to a familiar tactic in order to build their profits. As NPR's Netta Ulaby reports, many of them are raising prices for the costly ad-free tiers.
Not many streaming services actually turn a profit. Some have reported billions in losses, including Disney Plus and Max, formerly HBO. Then there's Discovery Plus, home to such shows as 90 Day Fiancé.
I could not walk down the aisle today. It would be a lie.
Discovery Plus says it's in the black, but it just raised its price for ad-free streaming, now $9 a month. That's in line with other streamers that are keeping prices low for cheaper subscriptions, the ones with ads, but charging those who can afford it more and more for the pleasure of ad-free shows. Hulu, Amazon Prime, and Disney Plus will all soon charge more for ad-free tiers, and Netflix has hinted it plans to do the same. Netta Ulaby.
So, price increases were coming anyhow, and the writer's strike, where we made an agreement to pay more money, is going to boost those prices some more. Somebody has to pay for them. They weren't making much money to begin with. They were losing money. Lululemon and Peloton and their feud. I didn't know that they were spatting, but did you know they were spatting with each other? So, Lululemon and Peloton are abandoning efforts to get into each other's turf and instead striking a partnership that will let each company stick with its core business. So we're seeing competition and partnerships in marketing. Lululemon said it would discontinue sales of its Studio Mirror home fitness device before the end of the year. and instead steer those customers to Peloton's digital fitness classes. Peloton, which has tried to sell its own apparel collection, will start selling co-branded Lululemon attire at its stores and websites. So each is beginning to focus back on its core business. In 2020, Lululemon acquired Mirror for $500 million to compete against Peloton amid a surge in demand for home fitness equipment during the worst of COVID-19. Lululemon recently took a $408 million charge related to the fitness streaming program and a $63 million provision against hardware inventory. So that hasn't worked out for them. The impact of the pandemic continues, and not all acquisition ideas work out. Peloton in 2021 launched an apparel brand as it sought to expand beyond fitness equipment and digital subscriptions. The move sparked a legal fight after Lululemon sent a letter alleging some of the products, including Peloton's bras and leggings, infringed on Lululemon's patent designs. The dispute was settled last year, so here we see Lululemon protecting their brand against infringement. Under the new five-year partnership, they were able to make up. The companies will sell co-branded apparel starting October 11. Lululemon Studio subscribers will have access to the Peloton classes for the same price they currently pay starting November 1, and the company will discontinue its app-only membership tier. So, brand partnerships instead of brand feuding, I guess. So a little bit of sport sort of stuff, a little bit of fashion sort of stuff. Finally, brands are slowly going always on with Hispanic audiences. 2 years ago, consumer goods giant Danone North America was spending significantly less on media that targeted Hispanic audiences. Many advertisers only purchase Hispanic media for one-off campaigns and do not consider Hispanic audiences when constructing their overall media plan, their overall strategy. So a little bit about media budget, market segments. But during the volatility of 2021, the company was looking to find ways to extend its reach into communities that had already shown loyalty to its brands. Hispanic consumers were 37% more likely to consume probiotic yogurt than the general population, according to the market research. And Danone wanted to make greater inroads with that community via probiotic yogurt brand Activa. So we're seeing marketing research at work, which we're talking about in class. We're seeing growth via market penetration, selling more products to existing consumers. So the company did a media buy for Activa with Hispanic-focused streamer service Canela. And the results were impressive. The ads had particularly high video completion rates, and Canela delivered the highest return on investment of any other media channel. That's saying something. So here's their media channel selection. I have not had a chance to translate this, so I don't know what it's saying, but here we go.
Activa ambiciosa, delis deliciosa, fácil fantástica, animada rápida, probióticos dentro, creen su sabor, vibra vital, yogur sabroso, gózatelo. De la A a la Z, todo empieza en tu intestino, empieza con Activia.
So it's got a good beat. I don't know what they were saying, but it sounds like something good if you're looking for probiotics and you're Hispanic. After this success, Danone increased its investment in Hispanic audiences from a small localized test and learn campaign for one brand to multiple months long national campaigns, not just for Activa, but Silk, Danimals, and International Delight. So they're learning from a test run research and expanding it to marketing action. The most critical misstep brands make is only thinking about Hispanic audiences when they're reminded about it and not seeing this segment as a critical part of their media plans, says Karina DeBarro, Executive VP and Managing Director of Multicultural Marketing at Horizon Media. So understanding consumer segments. And here for Activa, it looks like it was a pretty good deal to better understand the Hispanic segment and use marketing research to get there. All right, so on the lecture notes, page 115, chapter 8, and page 231 of the textbook, continue our discussion of marketing research. So we left off last time looking at the types of marketing information. As you recall, then we had secondary data from internal and external sources. We had primary data, facts and figures newly collected for the project, from watching people or from asking people about stuff. That's where we left off last time.
I guess we do market.
So here, I don't think we got to Dan talking about him using marketing research over at Timken, did we? Did we get that far?
Yeah. I guess we do market research both ways. We have people in market manager positions, that's their full-time job, is to, for the market they're assigned to, their job is to go understand that market, the trends in the industry, what do customers want, and that's really where a lot of the ideas for new product innovation comes from. We also, though, will use outside firms for, I'll say, the really big jobs. And an example of that would be understanding the wind energy market, which is a, you know, an emerging market where if you're a gear drive manufacturer, a bearing manufacturer, it's really in the news today. And the wind energy market is so huge and it's so different in every country. That's an example where we've hired an outside company that does market research. That's their livelihood. And they can do a faster job and a more global job than we
than they can do internally. And the results from this research then suggested future roles for Timken in this particular area. So there's interesting job opportunities if you want to be inside an organization doing market research for them. 100 years ago, I did that with Tappan Appliances. I was their inside market research guy. Or you can work for a market research firm whose job is to do research for a bunch of entities, for a bunch of businesses. And they have impact on the businesses. They suggest where businesses should go next with their business. So let's go back and think about that idea of secondary data. We mentioned last time in passing that one advantage is secondary data, since it's already collected and sitting somewhere, it's fast. You can get it for that 15-minute meeting that's going on. It's inexpensive compared to doing new research. Sometimes, in some situations, depending on the research question, it might give you a good enough solution to move forward. So you don't have to do in primary research. Or maybe you can say, well, all right, this is where we were 2 years ago. Interesting. What's happening since? It might point the direction for you to do your new investigation, yeah? So you would always do secondary data collection first. You would hardly ever find an instance where you would just go out and do primary data collection without having any idea what's been done before, what's already collected, what do we already know? It's always struck me a little funny because it says secondary. It sounds like you should do it second. But no, you do it first. What are some disadvantages? Well, by definition, it's out of date. It was collected at some other time for some other purpose on some other sample size, etc. So it's always going to be out of date. And then the sample itself, the definitions they use in the research, the categories they put stuff together in is unlikely to fit your particular situation. Census data might be a few years out of date. They don't do it every 10 years. Might not be in the particular region that you want to know about or your particular subculture you're interested in studying. So it's not going to be, in some cases, specific enough. Primary data, well, the obvious advantage is it focuses on your problem at hand. You're doing it to answer whatever questions you have in mind right now. And so it's under your control. You define the categories, you define the time period, you define the parts of the country. Disadvantages are it can be quite costly and it does take time. You aren't going to get an answer for that meeting today. That's obvious. Here is our friend over at Protégé talking a bit about collecting primary verified shopper data at Protégé and how it works for them and their clients. So they're a third party. They collect data using their panels and sell answers to other companies.
Way before my time in market research, you know, they were doing mall intercepts. They were calling people on the phone. They were just really talking to people, you know, how we normally would, or even like doing mail-in surveys. Then in the early 2000s, everything navigated to being online. And so we saw a big uptick in online quant and qual work. Even still have some in-person shops coming to us today saying, hey, now we can't do that. And in order for our business to stay relevant, we're having to adopt to Zoom calls. So still kind of having that face-to-face aspect, but doing it online. But that was all self-reported data. So where this is continuing to navigate to is online work, because of course it's more efficient and cost-effective to conduct online research than say fly a team to, you know, Minnesota to go to a specific mall and try to intercept people. So that is still very important, but we also want to have verified data as much as possible. So a lot of investments for Protégé is going towards verified data. The way that we do that is looking at behavioral data and also shopping data. But with behavioral data, that is using a browser extension. So you might be using a web browser extension for, you know, say like Honey. That's a big one that people use for coupons, or RetailMeNot, another big one for coupons. We have something similar for our members, but additionally what that's doing and what they've consented to in order to earn rewards is that we can track the websites that they're going to. And so we can tell if one of our members is going to Amazon.com and when they check out. And then from there we can say, okay, you bought items from Amazon on June 3rd, and then start digging into what they were buying, what took them there, etc. With the verified shopping data, that is becoming really valuable as well, because in the CPG and retail space, everybody's doing research at some point in their product lifecycle. And so with that shopper data, we're able to see like a longitudinal data set. So this has been 2 years in the making. And so what we're continuing to track and be able to pick out is this survey respondent was going to, you know, Kroger grocery store. For most of 2020, they were buying Coca-Cola. But then why, you know, around the holidays, November and December, why did they switch to Pepsi? And so we've got that verified data. We're not guessing. We're not asking them to report that themselves. We've got it there, cold, raw data. And then our clients can go in and dig out, hey, we noticed these trends, you know, what's going on? Maybe they were having family over, and maybe the family is vehemently against Coca-Cola and they like Pepsi, who knows? So all in all, it's getting to having verified data so that you can get more granular in the questions that you ask folks. The best way to leverage that shopper data or behavioral data is by saying, we can see that these people were shopping at specific stores within a specific time frame or bought specific items, and then still go do a quant or qual study with them, just knowing that it's verified.
So you think about it, I can ask you, over the summer, did you tend to buy Coke or Pepsi, and did you ever switch? And you can kind of remember, maybe. But then what about that time when you went to the beach on vacation? Were you buying Coke? Well, you don't know. You just answer the question the best you can. And it's better than nothing, but it's not really accurate. This particular company has the advantage. You sign up for their service. They're going to give you perks for using their browser. And they literally can see what you were shopping for, where you were looking, what you bought, as long as it's online, over time. So it's they're both primary research, asking you and observing you. But one's a little more true. And then when there's some odd behavior, so why did you switch to Pepsi at the beach? We can go back and do interviews with you. So it's sort of an interesting approach to collecting primary data for their clients. Fender, any guitar players here? Just one, two, any women guitar players here? So Fender found out recently that women play the guitar. Whoa! A survey of a representative sample, so it was indeed a probability sample, of guitar players in the U.S. and the United Kingdom found that women account for 50% of all beginner and aspirational players of guitars. And the instrument maker, that is Fender, is adjusting its marketing focus accordingly. Marketing research for marketing action. So here we see a new set of ads that came out. And in case you can't tell, these are women players.
Pop and hip-hop dominate today's music chart. So it's not surprising there have been a number of articles proclaiming the death of guitar rock. But as Allison McCabe reports, rock and guitars are still plenty popular. And some guitar makers are starting to recognize that players come in all shapes, sizes, and genders.
When leading guitar maker Fender conducted a consumer survey, it was surprised to discover that women made up half of first-time guitar buyers. Andy Mooney is Fender's CEO.
That was a big surprise to us, because I think if you asked most people in the company or in the industry what the gender mix was, they would have said maybe 70-30 or maybe even 80-20 male to female.
Mooney acknowledges that outdated assumptions may have contributed to sales declines over the last decade. The nation's largest instrument retailer, Guitar Center, is facing more than $1 billion in debt. Guitar maker Gibson filed for bankruptcy earlier this year. and privately held Fenders debt is estimated at $100 million.
There was probably a misconception in the industry that everybody who bought a guitar for the first time wanted to be a long-haired guitar god. That's a very small percentage of the total universe, less than 10%.
And so we don't even know who's buying our guitars. It takes research to get out there and learn more about your customer base and then adjust your marketing strategy appropriately. How can you not know that, you would say? How can you be a manufacturer and not know what your customers are, who your customers are and what they're buying? Because you don't sell directly guitars to them. They're out in stores. They're out buying stuff. You've got to do research to find this stuff out. 2020 has seen an astronomical spike in the popularity of the guitar. This increase in demand was unprecedented. Keeps growing steadily. For some context, during the height of the 2009 financial crisis, guitar sales plummeted, reaching a low of $821 million in the U.S. Despite slow and steady growth in sales since then, many thought that the guitar was on its way out. However, with the COVID-19 pandemic and the resulting global lockdown, interest in the guitar had grown rapidly. Guitar sales increased by 15% from 2019 to 2020, with online retailers amassing the bulk of these sales. That is thanks to a recent wave of beginning guitarists, with the majority of them picking up the acoustic guitar. Top brands like Fender have experienced record sales, and so have retailers like Guitar Center and Sweetwater. Historically, the guitar playing universe used to be dominated by men, but roughly 45% of those who started playing guitar in 2020 are female. Who's your market segment? Who's buying your product? How do you create ads that appeal to that market segment? All right. A source of secondary data that's big out in the real industrial world is syndicated research. Syndicated research is research conducted by a market research firm in an area that might be of interest to multiple companies or organizations within a particular industry. So they go out there, they know the industry, they know the players, they know the interesting questions and data that should be collected. And either you subscribe to them to have them, you be part of that data collection, or they go ahead and collect it and then they come back to you and they say, hey, you're a manufacturer of gas ranges, electric guitars, women's clothing. I have a study that, here's a little teaser part of it, you can buy into and have this research available to you. So the market research firm leverages its industry expertise and experience to determine the subject and the scope of the study, including the questions to ask, the populations to target, and it offers its results and analysis out to multiple clients. This, of course, becomes an issue of efficiency. Because that same research results are purchased by several companies, the cost of performing the research is spread out among the companies. Each one doesn't have to run their own research study. Investing in syndicated research is often a cost-effective solution for firms seeking to gain valuable market insight. For example, it can give you an overview of that market, giving you a clear representation of who are the players out there, whether they are customers or clients or businesses. And again, you would say, don't companies know that? They don't. Fender did not know who the first-time purchaser of their guitars were. When I worked for this appliance company that I mentioned, we built appliances, we sent them off into the wholesale market. We don't know what the retailers are selling to, what price they're pricing it at, who their customer base is. We just didn't know that information. This sort of stuff helps you get that info. Identify industry trends. It's useful for organizations looking to understand the market landscape and how they fit into that landscape. It can measure brand awareness. Do people think of you? Do they know you? Your strength, their perceptions. So multiple companies who invest in the syndicated research can see how their brands and product offerings are viewed among customers and potential customers compared to those of their competitors. That's rich information for you. It can offer competitive intelligence, giving you information on how to best position your company in that competitive market. So that's pretty good stuff if you're a business, if you're a marketer. Syndicated research sources can be classified based on their unit of measurement. So sometimes they focus on you, the B2C consumer, the ultimate household, or B2B, they might be focused on institutions, just depending on, well, what their focus is, what their target audience is. Household consumer data can be obtained from surveys, from panels who keep diaries on information, Have you seen any ads over the last 2 weeks for cars? What cars did you see ads for? What did you do with the information about the car ad that you saw? Keep your diary of what's going on. Or electronic scanner services. Some of you guys use a grocery card to get a little discount at the grocery store or something like that. Three of you. All right. Webbies, how about you? So what are they doing when you do that? They don't care who you are individually. They don't want to know that you're John and you live in Stowe, but they do want to know, as in the aggregate, who's buying what, when are they buying it, what are they switching with? Are you buying kumquat-flavored ding-dongs with Pringles or separately? They want to know what's going on in mass so they can track that information. You're giving them information when you use your scanner. Institutional data is obtained out from retailers and wholesalers or manufacturing and other industrial firms. So here for the visual learners, here's we're saying we can collect data from household and consumers through surveys. And if you remember back when we talked about measuring lifestyles through psychographic studies like the Vowles experiment or Vowles study, that would be a survey of household consumers, general surveys, evaluating advertising through surveys. Or panel data, we can either watch you purchase stuff or watch what media you watch. Anybody happen to have a family that was involved in any of the Nielsen data collection, Nielsen study? So Nielsen is a data research firm that collects information on media habits. Sometimes we get somebody whose family was on a panel there. Electronic scanner surveys, I just mentioned those, so that we can track volume. We can use them for a panel of information. As you know, in the old days when people actually subscribed to cable TV, I know that's an old idea, different parts of the city, different neighborhoods, could actually get different ads sent to them. And then you could track, knowing where people lived, you could track whether or not it impacted their shopping behavior. On the institutional side, the business side, we audit retailers and wholesalers, collect data from them. Or we go to manufacturers and industrial firms and we do direct inquiries from them, clipping services about things that are published about them, or we go to their corporate reports and collect data. Then there are a whole bunch of other resources you can make use of. You can go to online databases like LexisNexis, ProQuest, the US Census data. You can get statistical and financial data from the Wall Street Journal, CNBC, Investors, and Fox Business. You can use portals and search engines, obviously Google and US.gov, to do some basic research on stuff. On the primary data side, we can do things using mechanical observation. So Nielsen, as I just mentioned, they actually have, if you're part of their panel, a device that watches to see what shows you're watching on television. When people used to watch TV. They know who's in the room. They actually can scan how many people are in the room. Anybody here still using a DVR from their cable service at all to record shows and whatever? How about TiVo? Any TiVo users? Yeah? I love TiVo. I don't know, they never caught on, it obsessed me so much. TiVo's so much better than that stupid Spectrum DVR, you and I. So anyhow, both the DVR system from Spectrum or whoever and TiVo report back to their masters and overlords what shows you're watching, when you watch them, how many weeks you went back, how many shows you watched in a row. Not you individually, they don't care about you, but in mass. It's a way of mechanically observing what's going on. You know that all your web cookies report back to their overlords what you browse, what you've seen, what's going on, what you bought, yeah? Or we can collect data directly by observing people. Mystery shoppers, anybody work for a company that had a mystery shopper ever? Yeah, yeah, so you knew they were coming, they knew that you had your standards, that you knew that they'd be reporting back, perhaps on you, a way to observe what's going on in the storefront. You can actually sign up to be a mystery shopper. Companies do that, so here's our secretshopper.com company, the premier mystery shopping company. Measure the customer experience. So measure what matters from global enterprises to local businesses. Use our friendly platform. Generates relevant insights that cannot be underestimated. Our mystery shopper programs play a pivotal role in enhancing customer satisfaction and ensuring continual business growth, sign up for the program or sign up to be a secret shopper. Videotaping. I'll tell true but sad story about what I believe was a well-intended market research thing. But when you hear it out loud, you say, that was stupid. It's a well-known problem for women fitting a bra. They actually have workshops for women at various department stores on bra fitting. So a bra manufacturer decided they want to get to the root of the problem. They videotaped women in their fitting rooms trying on bras. Well-intentioned as that was to see what the problem was, you can hear as I say it out loud how bad that was. And apparently they didn't announce to the women they were being videotaped. They just videotaped it and used it for research. That was pretty stupid, all right? Don't do that. Ask yourself, if this comes out in the newspaper, how's it going to sound? That's not going to sound good, even if you were well-intentioned. But there are other ways to use videotaping. For example, this is a videotaping heat map analysis. What they do here is they gather shopper flow data from your CCC cameras. The data are then manipulated by a patent-pending algorithm to create a visualization of the hot and cold areas of your store layout. And so the hot areas are places where people walk up, they stop, they examine the product, maybe they actually buy the product and put it in the store. Greener areas or lighter areas are places where they may browse and look, but maybe they don't stop and shop. Cold areas, people just walking right by it. So what's that mean for your product placement? What's that mean for what people are looking at, considering, and why is everybody over there in the hot spot? Is it the product? Is it the placement? I don't know. You might want to. So that's an idea of doing personal observation through videotaping. Ethnographic research. We're going to see ethnographic research when we get to MTV visiting teens in the Merchants of Cool. This is where you embed yourself in the consumer's life. You spend time with them one-on-one. Better yet, you watch them go shopping. You watch how they buy the product. You watch the things that they go through. You see what they try on, not by videotape. And so you observe them in their life. Anybody remember hearing the sociologist Margaret Mead, or is that too long ago? Margaret Mead, yeah. So she, no, you're just messing with me. All right. Yeah, tell me, do a little essay for me on Margaret Mead, yeah. So Margaret Mead was an anthropologist, not a sociologist, and she embedded herself in the Polynesian islanders' life to know richly who they were. Marketers don't go that far, but they do go out and follow a consumer around and see what sort of issues and problems they have. We'll see it in two different ways coming up presently. So that's personal observation in depth with the consumer. Field Agent is another way of collecting primary data. It's a consumer app for primary data collection. You can make money with your iPhone by completing small jobs with Field Agent. What is it? It's an app connecting clients, businesses, marketers, in need of marketing research data with agents, that would be you, who can provide that information. App users become the agents, answering the survey questions and performing small tasks for cash sums, allowing the clients to gather large samples of data via crowdsourcing. Crowdsourcing for marketing research, wow. We've made it our mission to pay people real money through their iPhone for doing work. We paid over $1.8 million to thousands of agents, assuming it's still up and real. It was last time I checked. So here we go, Field Agent, retail your way. Field Agent solutions let you audit stores, drive, trial, generate reviews, and connect with shoppers anywhere, anytime. Get started with our program. And here's a bunch of folks that have used Field Agent to crowdsource market research. Pretty cool. So how else can we collect data? Well, we can do through surveys. That's a way we're certainly all thinking about, have thought about over time. So we can just question consumers. So we got to generate some questions. How do we do that? Well, we can sit down with a bunch of individuals, maybe not a probability sample, just some users. Have you used our product? Do you like it? What would you think about the competition? What'd you like about our product? What didn't you like about our product? You do 10 or 15 or 20 of these and you begin to get some ideas about what's going on, what you should be asking about. And then that becomes a more formal basis for a more formal survey. Or you can really go in depth, not just casually chat with people and talk for them extensively about their experience. Or you can engage in focus group research. A focus group is a group of 8 or 10 people. You bring them together. Has anybody ever done a focus group study for anything? So you bring them together, 8 or 10 people in a room. You have a moderator that has a list of questions they try to get through. But then each focus group takes on its own direction. Oh, you think that our ding-dong should come in other flavors. What other flavors do you think? Kumquats? Wow. What do you think about kumquats? Oh, you think it might be a good idea, too. So we wander off in new areas, and then we come back. And now let's return to Pringles or whatever. So you get interesting ideas. And you don't just do one group. You do 3 or 5, 10, 12 people each. We used to, back in the early days of appliances, we hadn't yet resolved what microwave panels would look like. When people want to twist dials, and they want to slide things, they want to push buttons, we didn't know. So we created a bunch of mock-up panels, talk about expensive, flew them all to Chicago, set up a bunch of focus group studies at their airport, and asked people questions about microwave oven panels to see what they wanted. And then that becomes the basis for additional research. Fuzzy front-end techniques. These are unusual ways to identify maybe new cool trends. I tell you, you're going to come in for a study on fashion. I'm going to give you some money up front. You're going to go out and buy a bunch of fashion magazines. And then you're going to cut out the most interesting things that you think we would want to know about. You're going to bring those in, and we're going to put them up on the wall, and we're going to see what they tell us. A fuzzy front-end technique to see where we should go with our research. There are other interesting approaches as well. Then we're going to evaluate the ideas that we come up with from this set of beginning front-end stuff. We might do personal interview surveys. We now have the questions formulated. We're going to ask you the questions. We could do telephone surveys, hard to do these days in the B2C world since everyone screens you, but the B2B world still happens. We could do a mail or a fax survey, email, internet surveys, or there are still malls around that work. We can stop people in malls and ask them to evaluate these ideas that we came up with from our early research. The question formats themselves, there's a variety of approaches we can take. We want to think about what question format to use based on what we're trying to get out of the study, what we're trying to get out of the research, and how much work we're going to put into it as researchers. For example, open-ended questions are things like, if students asked, I would tell them that marketing 25010 is, and then they tell you whatever they want to tell you. You might get a long answer, you might get a short answer, you might get an answer focused on the test, or the quiz, or the professor, or the content, or the testing. This is a simple example. Think about how much work you have to put as a researcher into then coding all of this content. Is it positive? Is it negative? Is it neutral? What's it about? So open-ended research can give you depth, but it can be costly to get done. You have a lot of work to do to make sense out of open-ended research, but it depends on your goal. Close-ended or fixed alternative questions could be things like, marketing 25010 is outstanding, pretty good, fair, pretty bad, horrible. Don't answer that question right here while I'm listening. And you can see how much simpler this is to use as a researcher. What's the problem? It's quick and dirty. You don't have any depth. What did they mean when they said it's horrible? All of it? Part of it? You don't know. Dichotomous question formats, one of two possible responses. How old are you? Less than 21 years old? 21 years or older? That's it. Easy to code. And if it gives you what you needed, you're good. Do you think that marketing 25010 is a good class for business students? Yes? No. Not very rich in detail, but maybe that's all you need to know. Semantic differential. Here the response is given on a set of bipolar adjectives. And what we're going to do is build a profile based on these adjectives. What adjectives do you use? Well, they have to be whatever you know is important to your particular research. I don't know. So in this case, please indicate your feeling about marketing 25010. Interesting or boring is presumably pair of adjectives that are important to the research: simple, complex, useful, useless, good or bad. These have to represent what the researchers think are important. You do all the research, you average the responses, and you develop a profile. So in this case, overall, it seems as though it's sort of interesting. It leans in between simple and complex, sort of useful, and sort of good. That profile by itself tells you something at this point in time. Maybe you'd compare it to Marketing 25010 with other professors, Marketing 25010 in other years, or maybe you compare it to a different brand, this being the brand example, and we're going to compare it to Thermocalculus. There's no such course. Thermocalculus, as you can see, is quite boring, very complex, sort of useful, and in between good and bad. Quite a different profile here. So if you're comparing brands or companies, different segments of opinion, different age groups, you can see where the differences might be. So semantic differential gives you a profile on critical adjectives for your brand, for your company, lets you see differences. Likert scale, here respondents rate the degree of agreement with a statement. So this is a Likert scale for Marketing 25010. Marketing 25010 is a good class. I strongly disagree. I disagree. I'm neutral. I agree. I strongly agree. Again, easy to code, easy to work with. Does it answer the research question needed answered? Which one's right? There is no right one. All of the formats can be useful. The one you choose has to match the goal of the research. And writing the question itself to get at what you want, to be unbiased, can critically influence the results. It's an art in itself. In politics, we will see often leading questions. So you get a survey that reads as following. Many truly patriotic Americans prefer to purchase products manufactured in the United States. Do you prefer to purchase products manufactured in the United States? Can you see any bias in the way the question is written? And that you actually find that sort of stuff in the real world, which is why sometimes I say you got to know who collected the research, for what purpose, with what bias. And then this gets reported back as 95% of Americans prefer to buy U.S. goods. Wait a minute. How is the question asked? So, if you're the researcher, you know that answer. We can collect primary data. We've already alluded to this from panels, an ongoing group of consumers or stores in the B2B world who agree to provide information over time, giving us longitudinal information. We can run experiments. We're going to carefully control the cause, the stimuli, the ad, the price, the packaging, and measure the important results, the dependent variables. Do people pay attention? Does it affect their beliefs, their attitudes? Importantly, does it affect sales? You remember me giving the example of the blind taste test for the Michigan blueberry example? Remember that one? So in a blind taste test, you got a particular result. Here's a blind taste test of ketchup. So they go through this elaborate thing with ketchup, run an experiment to find out which of these brands is most preferred. So they carefully hide the evidence. So there's the ketchup. You obviously can't tell which brand it is. And run the experiment. And the winner was Annie's Organic Ketchup. The runner-up was Whole Foods 365 Organic. Third place was everyone's favorite, Heinz Ketchup. So they ran a bit of an experiment, carefully controlling the situation. Test markets are really elaborate experiments. Here, I create an entire marketing mix, a product, a price, a place, a promotion. I get it out into the retail store in Buffalo and in Akron. And why Buffalo and Akron in my example? Because they're carefully studied to be comparable types of markets with comparable types of demographics and income and retail distribution. But in one place, I want one kind of ad or set price in a particular way. And over here, I do it. Set the price of the promotion in a different way. You can see that's a controlled experiment, as much as you can do in the real world. and we see what was the impact of the ad, what was the impact of the price on our situation. Social media can be used to do research, to collect data, track your social media platforms for mentions and conversations related to your brand, then analyze those for insights to discover opportunities to act. So it's a two-step process. First of all, you have to monitor social media channels for mentions of your brand, your competitors, your products, your keywords related to your business. And then analyze the information for ways to put what you learn into action. It could be something as small as responding to a happy customer, or something as big as shifting your entire brand positioning. When this was a brand new idea, I was still taking students to Europe. We went to Nestle's headquarters in Vevey, which I mentioned before. And they were bringing people in from all over the world in small groups to train them on this new idea of social media marketing and using it for research. Over here, they had an entire wall of displays that was tracking what was being mentioned across their brands. And you could see in real time things being mentioned. Over here, they had a series of panels where people were responding to what was being mentioned. And over here was a whole panel of them responding to what people were saying about whatever was going on. And they were training their global people on how to make this process work. I don't remember what my Dannon example is. Let me see what this takes us to. From asking to listening, how Dannon is using social insight to stay relevant. Dannon uses social listening to get a deeper understanding of what really matters to people, which has become all the more important since the onset of the pandemic. So they're out there studying social media to collect primary data. So one executive brags to another, I get 300 emails a day. The other one says, that's nothing. I get 500 emails a day and 50 voicemails. Unfortunately, it's not a joke. There's not a funny punchline to this. The reality is that as we manage our businesses in a network world, we're increasingly overwhelmed with information and communication. As extended global enterprises become the norm, think about how long the email string has to become over time just to make a single decision. It's goofy. So this guy's somewhat overwhelmed, as you can see. So we have to find ways to navigate this information overload. We have to find new ways to govern, measure, and make decisions in the extended enterprise. We're my information system people, IS, CIS, CS, anybody? Nobody's in that area? No CISers? Okay. We need some people doing that, please. So information systems, the ongoing organized procedure to generate information, analyze information, disseminate information, store information, retrieve information for use in making marketing decisions. What good does it do you if I go out and run that primary data study, run those videotapes, collect that focus group research, and it never gets anywhere anybody can use it? It just gets stored somewhere on a shelf. Well, what are you talking about? And it's on and on and on in a big enterprise. So it is our friends over in information systems that help us to turn this into useful data, useful information. So here we're showing a little bit about what goes on in an intelligent marketing enterprise platform. We have data coming into our warehouse from all over. Our internal data sources, secondary data research, customer orders, customer data, inventory, sales calls, promotion. External data sources, also secondary. Global sources, trade associations, census data, Internet of Things, single source services. We get our cloud environment with data storage and cloud computing capabilities and artificial intelligence. We get our primary data collection, buying inquiries, who buys, how much do they buy, why do they buy? All this goes through analytical tools to organize, manipulate, analyze, present the data from our data warehouse, coming out, if we do it right, into useful results that then can be used by decision makers to do the right thing. Data mining. So we got this data warehouse. Look at how much stuff is in it. And of course, now we have ongoing, real-time, real-world stuff happening right now, just dumping into this data warehouse. Dumping, dumping, dumping. Hundreds, thousands, millions of bits of information. How do you make sense out of that? Well, data mining is an analytic process that extracts hidden predictive information from large databases to find links between consumers' purchasing patterns and marketing actions. We all know that AI analyzes data and gives us answers in ways we don't really understand. Are you aware of that? We don't understand the algorithm that it used to get to its answers. Data mining can sort of do the same thing. It's AI, a more advanced form of data mining. It goes out there, it looks at all this information and finds the links between consumers' purchasing patterns and marketing actions and tells us, but we aren't sure exactly how it got there. So these data warehouses can be analyzed in the same way as smaller databases looking for predetermined patterns. But due to its size, it'd be impossible to do this in a data warehouse. It would be slow, it would be cumbersome. So more advanced statistical techniques and artificial intelligence techniques called data mining allow us as marketers to identify patterns and meaningful relationships in that data and to act on it. You guys know the entertainment company and casino company Harrah's? Do you know them at all? No bettors here? Harrah's? So they're a very large entertainment casino company. And a while ago, they got involved in research. If you're in a casino and you do more than put money in the nickel slot, you still have nickel slots, I don't know, you get a gambling card. So they can track on your gambling card, they do know who you are. They do know what sort of room you're in. They do know where you're spending money. They do know what you're gambling. They do know your wins and losses. Are you a little fish? Are you a big fish? Are you a big fish? Are you a big fish? Are you a mammoth whale? They want to know who you are and what they can do for you, and what they should do for you. So what they did is they used this data to collect information, use data mining techniques to develop 90 customer segments based on their gambling behavior, their profit projections, and then they determined their promotional packages based on the segment you were in. In the day, really big news in the industry, cashing in on consumer loyalty by relying mainly on gut feel of marketers and salespeople, companies keep making the same mistakes. But Harrah's used customer insight to turn the tables on the gaming industry, came up with all this good information, and were able to apply it in interesting ways to develop these segments. So it worked for them. Little data mining humor. Dogbert, the creepy dog consultant, talks to the stupid pointy-haired boss. You need to do data mining to uncover secret sales trends, hidden sales trends. If you mine the data hard enough, you can also find messages from God. Sales to left-handed squirrels are up, and God says your tie doesn't go with that shirt. That's supposed to be funny, by the way. Pointy-haired boss says to Dilbert, we have a gigantic database full of customer behavior information. Dilbert says, excellent. We can use nonlinear math and data mining technology to optimize our retail channels. Pointy-haired boss says, if that's the same thing as spam, we're having a good conversation here. So he's not quite on board with what we're talking about. All right, so we've done all this stuff we've talked about. We finally got the data. We're ready to develop our findings using the appropriate techniques, given the particular approach we took to our data collection, which we've just been talking about. We analyzed the data. Then, as marketing researchers, we have to keep in mind we did this for a reason, to help management make decisions. So we have to present the findings in a clear manner for action that management can consider given the research question. Take the action. So we're going to act on the recommendations, we're going to implement the actions, and then we use research to evaluate the actions. How did this all work out? Did awareness build? Did attitudes improve? Did sales increase? We'll see what's going on. The next little piece I borrow is, I admit, ancient, but what MTV did in the day to make use of the marketing research approach we've just talked about, some of it's still around, you'll see a little bit still relevant today, is quite impressive, including ethnographic research, going in and talking to the consumer to understand them better. We'll see a little snippet of that. This was actually done by a company that wanted to talk down about marketing research, and we'll see that come up as well. So here's the little credit piece. Mm-hmm.
Frontline is made possible by the annual financial support of PBS viewers like you. Thank you.
And here's the discussion of MTV in the day using marketing research.
Of the five media giants, the coolest conglomerate on the block is Viacom. And Viacom's crown jewel, there on the second floor, is MTV, which last year earned the company $1 billion in profits. A few years ago, when their ratings began to slip.
There was a perception that MTV had lost its way a bit with the young consumer. Ratings were down somewhat. Some of the trend studies said that we were less cool, less creative than before.
So MTV had the humility to realize that cool was not their birthright, that it belongs to kids and kids keep changing. If they wanted to stay cool, they'd have to change right along with them.
MTV felt like we needed to get a closer connection to the audience. Or we said, if we know more about them, know more about their lives, know more about who they are, what they want, what they don't want, we can make a better MTV as a better connection with the audience if we talk to them and listen to them a lot more.
We immersed ourselves in research about the fall of 97 and have been able to turn that around to where now our rankings when it comes to creative or original or funky or anything you would care about, musically relevant, have went way, way up, and our ratings are their highest in their history.
The new MTV is all about learning what kids really want, then delivering it to them.
UCD, Granddaddy.
To ensure that bond stays strong, MTV must understand where teen culture is moving. Market research is the mantra, and its guru is Todd Cunningham.
Some of this music is dead on for exactly what kind of stuff that our audience is going to want. And the research efforts at MTV are certainly legendary. There's been a kind of feverish addiction to research and understanding young people, and that's been embraced from the very top down.
MTV let us in on their techniques. Todd Cunningham told us to meet him at an address in the small town of Island, New Jersey. A short time after we arrived, a black town car pulled up. Cunningham, a former advertising industry executive, emerged with a member of his staff. This little field trip, Cunningham had explained, is called an ethnography study, in which MTV market researchers visit a typical fan in his home.
Hey.
Today, MTV is meeting John, an ordinary kid in every respect, who is carefully screened to make sure he is just that. It is hoped that by studying John in his natural habitat, MTV might gain insight into one of the most valuable segments of their viewing demographic, the teenage male.
I'd love to see, like, clothes. Like, what's your favorite thing you have? What's your favorite shirt?
Probably one of my sweaters. They're my drawers, if you want to see them.
Okay, well, we can look at that in a minute. What else? What else? What are the kind of things you wear usually? Like, what's...
I wear a lot of, like, khaki pants.
Yeah.
And I have some suits for church or whatever.
We shut the door in their bedrooms and talk to them about issues that they feel like are really important to them. We talk with them about what it's like to date today. What's like dealing with their parents? What things stress them out the most? What things are like really on the hearts and minds of them and their peers? I'm just curious about like things with like, you know, obviously if you want, just like with your girlfriend and stuff like that. And I mean, this is, we always ask these kind of questions about, are you like, how long have you guys been dating?
Since June 1st.
It's captured on video. So we have a camera crew, sound and light crew there. We cut that videotape together, put it to music, edit it in an MTV style way. We then take that around and show it to various department meetings, share with them the insights that we've learned.
So what happens to all this careful research, all the hours and dollars that MTV spends learning about who our kids really are? When all the tape is reviewed, what portrait of the American teenage male emerges?
The water
goes. Oh, God! Hot on my leg.
His critics call him the Mook. That's right, M-O-O-K, Mook. And you can find him almost any hour of the day or night, somewhere on MTV. He's not real, he's a character. Crude, loud, obnoxious, and in your face.
No.
He's Tom Green of the Tom Green Show, and he's the daredevils on Jackass who indulge in dignity-defying feats like poo diving.
Right, Don, and this is poo diving.
He's those frat boys and their whipped cream bikini girlfriends on MTV's constantly recurring spring break specials.
Hi, Terrence. What brand of pants am I wearing? Let me see.
He has migrated to MTV's sister network, Comedy Central, where he's the cartoon cutouts of South Park or the lads on The Man Show.
The juggies look nice, don't they?
Keep those rings.
So does the whole teenage experience come down to this? Are our boys mooks? Is John a mook? I don't think so. Maybe all that research isn't really about understanding John as a person. It's about understanding John as a customer. I mean, they don't call it human research or people research. They call it market research.
The MTV machine does listen very carefully to children. When corporate revenues depend on being ahead of the curve, you have to listen. You have to know exactly what they want and exactly what they're thinking so that you can give them what you want them to have.
It's funny to think that the most advanced form of marketing today comes in the form of a 300-pound body slam. Professional wrestling is the most popular form of entertainment among teenage boys in America. Today, wrestling is sheer spectacle, a magnificently honed lure for the teenage male channel surfer. And where there's pop, there's money. That's why wrestling has been propagated across the entire spectrum of teen media. It's broadcast 15 hours a week on 5 different networks and is seen by 15 million people.
It is huge with our audience at sort of program levels that I could have never imagined. It is the hottest thing going among males 18 to 24 and, in fact, among teen boys. And so we felt like while we don't want that to be the defining element of our business, it was okay to be in the game.
It was simply too big to ignore.
That's what it was.
Some comments. These guys are criticizing marketing research because it's not telling us the full story about the American male. That's not what the research was intended to do. It's investigating the male as a consumer, hence consumer research. So give me a break. Second of all, anybody know Rover's Morning Glory, the talk show? Those guys are absolutely mooks, including the girl on the show, the girls on the show too. They are mooks. They're still relevant today. How many of you guys grew up with, or maybe still what, South Park? Wrestling? Okay. MTV, it's a music company. What are they doing with wrestling? That's because it's not what people want now. They want other sorts of things. Now I think they've moved on to what, reality shows? Is that their big thing now? The point is not wrestling versus reality. The point is we're tracking our consumers. We're watching to see what they want. We're trying to stay ahead of the curve to deliver them what it is they want. So we're still cool with what's going on. So they actually do make use of that marketing research process, as we've talked about it, through the process to deliver actionable results back to their company. Was I going to make something else about that? So it's the stuff at work. All right, if you want to know more, we offer courses in marketing research, marketing 35 of 50, marketing analytics 35 of 61, or we have a business data analytics minor. That's the end. You can go away now. Thank you. Oh, yeah, mini test 6, whatever. 6 coming up, mini test 6.